In other news.
You know, the towers did not burn up. They turned into powder in midair.
That's scary to have this helicopter hovering around.
You walk up to him and confront him. They can't stand that.
Welcome to Another News. I'm Jeff Brady. Nearly 10 years ago, Dr. Brad Blanton presented a TEDx talk about his work. His first book, titled Radical Honesty, How to Transform Your Life by Telling the Truth, became a nationwide bestseller in 1996. We hear that TEDx presentation and part of an interview we did from 2013. Dr. Blanton is a psychotherapist, author, and seminar leader. We go now to that presentation. Let's have a listen.
Okay, so what about honesty? What would it be for you, just among your friends, to change the degree of honesty? What if you're just honest all the time with everyone that you know, the people that you already know, and you weren't too worried about being tactful or diplomatic? You just said whatever you thought, like a kid, like a child. What do you think it would do to your relationships? What would be different if you were radically honest? There's a story of a woman who interviewed for a job, and her potential boss asked her a question in the interview. What you consider to be your worst fault? And she said, honesty. And he said, I don't think honesty is a fault. And she said, I don't give a fuck what you think. I really like that joke. And I think, would you hire her if you were the boss? I would. I would want someone that I could depend on not to cater to me, that I could rely on to handle things and to be honest. So there is this problem about being honest about what's going through your mind. And the problem is that we have three minds. We have at least three minds. And we've been taught all of our lives that our mind is a very valuable thing and that thinking is the most important thing. And I don't think that's right. Our first mind is called the reactive mind. And that's basically we're a recording device. We've been recording multi-sensory recordings of what happens to us since we were in the womb. We weren't at no vision in there, but we got these multi-sensory recordings of successive moments of now. And we have them filed in a somewhat orderly fashion. Some of them weren't recorded too well. Some of them were a little off, but they are built into us. We have these records of things we've experienced. And they're not just sight and sound. They're tasty, touchy, feely, smelly, proprioceptive recordings. So that's one mind. That's called the reactive mind. And that's because whenever something was recorded that had a little bit of trauma in it or some shock or something like that, that got recorded with it. And then every now and then, those things just kind of pop up later on in your life. So that's the reactive mind. The next mind is called the personal construct mind. And that's based on replicated experiences. We have this experience of something over and over again. Say the baby has the experience of nursing and then not nursing and then nursing and not nursing. And after a while, after many, many repetitions of this, a little construct begins in the mind of the baby. Nursing time and not nursing time. And then the baby cries when it wants nursing and gets nursed. And after a while, that gets in there and she starts operating on the construct, nursing, wanting nursing, crying, and then getting nursed. And it works just fine, except when she wants nursing and she cries and she doesn't get it, she gets really, really pissed off. And we have all these little things in there of expectations associated with constructs that we built in our minds. That's the what we call the personal construct mind. And then we have the categorical mind, or the planning mind, the linear mind, the one we usually think of as our mind. It's mostly verbal skills. It has to do with having definitions of things. It points to objects and ideas, the mind the way we think of it. The problem is that these three minds turn on and off more or less at random, and they're not very accurate. In fact, there is a section of one of my books titled, it's a takeoff on the advertisement from the American Negro College Fund. They say, a mind is a terrible thing to waste. And my book says, a mind is a terrible thing. Waste it. These minds are very unreliable instruments. And one of the things that makes them unreliable is that they tend to get mixed up. They confuse each other. Like our categorical mind likes to take responsibility for things that just popped into our head. We think it's basically just used to rationalize the impulse that came from the reactive mind. So then what are we to do? Well, a New Yorker was stopped by a tourist and said, how do I get to Carnegie Hall? And she said, practice, practice, practice. Practice is what we need. And what you need to do is practice knowing the difference between noticing and thinking. Knowing the difference between noticing and thinking, and in a new context, that is, you've been taught that thinking was the most important thing your whole life. That's wrong. Noticing is much more important than thinking. Thinking is an unreliable mess. We have three minds, and all of them are screwed up, and they're interfering with each other, and the reactive mind is always trying to come up with things that, and the construct mind came up with an idea that wasn't accurate in the first place, and now it's forgotten about halfway. It interferes with the linear mind, and we all try to take credit for the ideas that come to us, but basically, we didn't come up with them. They just jumped out of our mind. So basically, the mind is not a very reliable thing. In order to get some clarity, we need each other. Because my faulty mind needs to have a report delivered to your faulty mind. And we have to be able to talk about it. Which means, if we're not honest, we'll just be even more fucked up than we already are. So what we're after is some kind of clarity. What we're after is something called cohorted co-intelligence, and I'll get to that at the end. So what are we to practice? We practice distinguishing between noticing and thinking. Now, stick with me here. With the whole awareness continuum, everything we can possibly be aware of can be divided easily into three parts. You can be aware of what's going on outside of you right now. I can be aware of you. You can be aware of me right now. That's one aspect of the awareness continuum. The second aspect is you can be aware of what's going on within the confines of your own skin right now, in your body. Sensations, heat, cold, tingling, tension, warmth, where they are in your body, you can be aware of that. And the third aspect is you can be aware of what's going through your mind right now. All of these awarenesses are right now, and that's all there is. I call it inside, outside, upside down, after my favorite children's book. So you can notice what's going on in your body, you can notice what's going on outside of you, and you can notice what's going through your mind right now. Only problem is, if you actually say to your the voices in your mind, okay, go ahead, I'm listening, all of a sudden your mind doesn't know whether to shit or go blind. It just doesn't say anything because it's run by resistance. If you try to stop your mind, that's the best way to keep it going. So the noticing is noticing what's happening outside of you, what's noticing what's happening in your body, and noticing what's going through your mind. And radical honesty is reporting what you notice, period. And you report what you notice without any particular common ways of lying, like politeness and being diplomatic. Diplomacy works just the way the world is completely fucked up, and it's by diplomacy. Now, usually we talk about either we go to war or you use diplomacy. That's not true. Diplomacy is what causes war. So what we're after is to get the value of paying attention. If you're going to report to another person what you notice in your minds, you have to report everything in all three minds. And they'll be contradictory. And your reactive mind will come up with something. You'll say that out loud, and then your linear mind will come up with something else. You say that out loud. They contradict each other. And then your personal construct mind says something else, and people think, what are you, crazy? All these things are going through your mind? Yes, and so are you. So we crazy people have to figure out a way to do a better guess at what's going on. But if you're lying, nobody gets the chance to intervene for you, and you don't get a chance to intervene for anyone else. So what is the value of honesty? You see, life is trouble, period. If you have three minds, you got trouble. If you tell a lie, you'll get in trouble. If you tell the truth, you'll get in trouble. So lying gets you in trouble and telling the truth gets you in trouble. And the question arises, which is the best kind of trouble? And the best kind of trouble is the trouble that's caused whenever you speak the truth, even if it upsets somebody or hurts their feelings or offends them. I recommend that you offend people, and I recommend that you hurt people's feelings. And I recommend that you stick with them until they get over it. It only takes about 90 seconds or so. So, thank you. So the noticing that you do has to be in a certain order. We like for you to notice what's going on outside of you first. Use your eyes and ears and your sense of balance and your relationship to gravity and notice what's going on in the world first. And then report that to whoever's around. And then secondly, notice what's going on within the confines of your own skin. I notice there's sort of tension in my stomach, a little tension on the right-hand shoulder over here, and a little movement here. You report that. And only after you've reported those two, then you start reporting what's going through your minds. Now, the best way to get in touch with what's going through your mind is to start from the right place. And the right place is not in your mind. You never want to begin any new project by thinking. In fact, you want to be grounded in your experience, which means the awareness continuum. I ran this 8-day-long workshop for about 20 years, three or four or five times a year. It was 8 days long. It was about 16 people each time. And we spent 12 or 14 hours a day trying to get what a year of psychotherapy would do condensed down into 1 week. And about 10 years into it, we discovered this amazing discovery. We discovered a chant that puts you on the road to enlightenment. And in fact, you're enlightened within 3 minutes. Now, I usually charge a whole lot of money for this, but I'm going to give it to you guys for free. This is the chant that will lead without fail to enlightenment within 3 minutes.
Da da da.
And if you slobber, you can get there in 2 minutes. If you slobber, you just get dumber than a stick. Dumber than a box of hammers. You just go, That's the way you start if you want to get enlightened. You don't get enlightened by being smart. Being smart is the biggest block to enlightenment there is. All right, it's not by thinking. So, if you get grounded in your dumbness, what we call dumbfounded, if you get dumbfounded, there is a way you begin to notice the way you usually interrupt noticing, which is with your mind. And the reason for doing all this is this. When you experience an experience, it comes and goes. And when you resist experiencing an experience, it persists. And the major form of resisting your experience is by thinking. So if you're thinking, trying to think your way around things, what you first need to do is to stop thinking and feel your way through things. When you open up to your awareness in your body, and your awareness of the other being across from you, and your awareness of what's going through your mind, and you report them all, not as an advocate trying to persuade how you're right and they're wrong or something, but just a report so you can share and check each other out. Then you tell the truth about what you're experiencing, because it's vital information that both of us need in order for us to be able to make it in the world. And I believe that your personal happiness is critically related to this, is dependent on this. And I think that the survival of humankind is too. So I want you to get out there and start being radically honest. Thanks.
That was Dr. Brad Blanton presenting in a TEDx talk nearly 10 years ago. Before we hear this next interview with Dr. Blanton, here are some passages from his book, Radical Honesty. Listen to this. The word, quote, radical, incidentally, originally referred to the juice in fruits and vegetables, the moisture provided through the root, radix, R-A-D-I-X, in Latin. It later came to mean the essence or substance of things. Radical does not mean far out, but rather far in. Radical honesty would be the core of truth, not just the outward trappings. Just as there is the letter of the law and the spirit of the law, so there is literal truth and essential truth. In the book Instant Healing, past guest, author Dr. King, mentioned the source of all disease is tension in the body, stress. Putting another building block on this, Dr. Blanton writes in the introduction of Radical Honesty, quote, "The stress that kills or cripples most of the population comes from people being too hard on themselves when they don't live up to their own imaginings about how other people think they should behave. We don't know who we are, and we try to guess who we ought to be in order to do the right thing and be happy. We get lost in the process, beat the heck out of ourselves before we even know we're hurt. It does no good whatsoever simply to change what we imagine others expect of us. We need to recover the ability to pay attention to something other than the whirlpool of questions and doubts about what is required or expected for acceptance. We've lost this ability to pay attention, to live outside the set of assumptions a mind is, and the only method of orientation left is given by the roles we have been trying on for size. In Chapter 7 of Radical Honesty, Dr. Brad Blatton writes, in this part titled, Direct and Indirect Expressions of Anger, how does a person used to suppressing anger learn to express it? It takes practice. The way anger is expressed has everything to do with the outcome of an argument. When anger is expressed in such a way that both people are fully present to the experience, the anger eventually goes away and the people have a new opening in their relationship. Anger is universal, but methods of expression vary. The continuum of expression ranges from murder to total suppression and cover-up. The continuum can be divided into two parts, indirect expression and direct expression. All indirect forms are sick and stupid. Many direct forms fail as well. Many people have tried to express anger directly at one time or another, but given up because, as some have said, quote, it only seemed to make things worse. It does make things worse for a short time, but much better over the long run. When people don't get good results from the direct expression of anger, the odds are the anger wasn't completely expressed. Probably one or both people were mad, but trying to be decent and fair at the same time. Dr. Blanton makes a point, trying to be constructive while wanting to destroy is a real dilemma. A division of energy between opposing goals and confusing. Divided expression doesn't work. This self-opposition with regard to expressing anger is what perpetuates anger. To express anger fully, we must give up most of our constraints on it. We can inhibit killing and physical violence, but we must be willing to be angry rather than decent and fair, because angry rather than decent and fair is what we presently are. After we're angry, we may be decent and fair, but we will never be authentically angry or authentically fair while we're struggling to be both at once. And there's another part that's very interesting titled, My Anger is Too Explosive, I Might Hurt Someone. Dr. Blanton writes, in the beginning, an attempt to change the habit of smothering anger can be explosive. The backed-up fund of resentment is released in a torrent. The first blow-up seems like a nuclear explosion, both because its magnitude and because it contrasts so dramatically with former politeness. After a little practice, the explosions become like conventional bombs, then like dynamite, then like firecrackers. The eventual goal is to have hundreds of tiny explosions a minute, like an internal combustion engine. This anger is good fuel to burn. It's a source of creative energy. Great metaphor. That's from the book titled Radical Honesty, How to Transform Your Life by Telling the Truth by Dr. Brad Blanton. Now let's go to hear the interview with Dr. Blanton. In our last interview with Dr. Judy Wood, she explicitly recited to, quote, know that you know what you know and know everything else that you don't know. A very important mantra for your own research. Past guest Professor Eric Larson wrote extensively on exposing the subtle toxic lies that infect the progressive media and its damage to culture and the arts. Today's guest has also written in depth about the importance of telling the truth and how all stress is caused by lying. He says we all lie casually and habitually, and we do it unconsciously. The most pernicious is withholding information. Psychotherapist, author, seminar leader, and twice independent candidate for the U.S. House of Representatives, Brad Blanton joins us to talk about his first book, Radical Honesty, How to Transform Your Life by Telling the Truth. The book was a nationwide bestseller in 1996 and explains very directly how to notice and stop various forms of self-deception and lying to others. Brad also offers an 8-day-long workshop called A Course in Honesty, and he'll be doing an online course soon called The Course of Completion. Brad Blanton, welcome to Another News.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
Certainly, it's a delight to have you on the show. You outline 3 levels of transitioning to tell the truth. Can you tell listeners what those are?
Well, you first have to make a distinction between what you notice and what you imagine, because we've all been taught systematically by the culture we grew up in to lie, to act as though interpretations of reality are reality. Take the Republican Party, for example. we're all taught to that thinking is the most important thing, and that there are things you should think and things you shouldn't think. And so one of the first distinctions for people who start telling the truth is to know the difference between the truth of experience, or what you notice with your eyes and ears, or what actually occurs in the world, as distinct from the meaning you automatically attribute to it. So if you say to someone, "I like your beautiful eyes," or "you have very nice hair," you're not talking about reality. If you say, "I notice you have hair and I imagine it's nice," you distinguish between what it is you're noticing and what it is you're elaborating with your mind about. I worked with couples for lots of couples for lots and lots of years, and been in lots of couples. I've never seen an argument between 2 people in a couple that had anything to do with reality. It always has to do with interpretation of reality. So one of them saying to the other, "If you'll buy my interpretation of reality, we'll get along fine, and if you don't, we won't get along." You have to do what I understand to be necessary and understand things to be the way they are that I interpret. So the first distinction is to be able to tell the difference between noticing and imagining. And the second thing to learn is to be able to describe what you notice. So the whole awareness continuum can be divided easily into 3 parts. You can notice what's going on outside of you right now. So if you're talking to another person, you notice their face, their movements, their gestures, and all the environment surrounding them. You can also notice what's going on within the confines of your own skin right now. You can notice sensations like heat, cold, pressure, tension, things like that. And then you can also notice what's going through your mind right now. And that's all there is. I call it inside, outside, upside down, because what's going through your mind is usually a whole bunch of BS about how things ought to be. But basically you can report, "I'm having the thought that you should not have spoken to me that way," or "I notice in my body tension, and I imagine I resent you for." So as long as you separate the noticing and the imagining, you can have a conversation where you can forgive each other and get over it. But if you can't separate the noticing and the imagining, then you can't get over anything. And the key to success in life, as far as I can tell after like 50 years as a psychotherapist, is being able to get over things and have new beginnings and new starts and renewal of connection, renewal of love and stuff like that. It requires fundamentally the distinction between noticing and imagining, and then your ability to do that at all levels. You have to know the difference between what's going on right now in the external world and what your imagining is going on in the external world. Most people would rather stick to their story than to observe or participate in reality. That's one of the reasons the world is so well organized and everything works out so well for everyone.
You would make a case that that is one of the foundations of major problems in the world today?
Yes. Uh-huh.
Reading through your book, you do point out that the book delineates the problems that result from not escaping your constantly interpreting lying mind.
Well, no, we're born with the ability to notice perceive. We learn language that tells us, along with there are pointer words that just name things, but the majority of what we call language are comparisons and evaluations. such as that, which are what we do with language to distort our perception of reality. Conception overrides perception. And when we think that what we conceive of, and that in our culture we highly value thinking, I don't value thinking so much. I think thinking is the booby prize. The mind is useful somewhat if you're grounded in your experience. And if you're not grounded in your experience, it's useless. It's worse than useless. It's just a damaging instrument. I've got a good mind, and which means that I'm most of the time removed from reality because of the BS that I'm daydreaming about. And when I don't highly value minds, I mean, basically, I would rather notice and have my life oriented by noticing than have it oriented by thinking. And so what we're born with is the ability to notice. And what we learn by the time we're about 2 years old is how to name and point to things, and then basically how to remove yourself from the experience of the noticeable world by being so lost in interpretation. But by the time you get to be a teenager, you think that reality has something to do with style. And it doesn't. So what I'm saying is that we can always go back and reground ourselves in the experiencing being that we are at any given moment if we're not so totally distracted by our minds that we can't get there anymore. Your ability to be grounded in noticing is much, much better skill or talent than whatever you can do with your mind. Bumper sticker we have basically says a mind is a terrible thing. Waste it.
The mind does get in the way of experience.
Yes.
You also mentioned that yesterday's truth is today's BS.
Yeah.
Can you explain that to listeners a bit?
Well, when you have a great dawning insight, oh my God, isn't that great? Or you fall in love or all that stuff. Basically, that's wonderful. And if you try to store it up or maintain it or make today be like yesterday, it's not but a few weeks before you're saying, why don't you love me like you used to do? You turn your life into a bad hillbilly song by trying to hold on to past love rather than to love and experience it and be very grateful and happy about it, get over it, and then be open to a new moment of connection with that person and with other persons. Today's brilliant liberating insight becomes something you're sort of memorizing and acting according to in like 2 or 3 weeks. And it happens a lot in golf, I notice, when I basically am a present to what I'm doing. When I'm making a golf swing, I'm using some information from the past in practice. But if I'm in my mind saying, oh, I need to get that swing back there further to the right, follow through better, everybody knows that's the way to screw up your golf game. Yeah. All good golfers know that their mind is the hardest thing there is to deal with in the whole game. Actually, the Masters is going on right now, and you can see that people's minds, as they're going down toward the last 2 days, are driving them crazy. So that basically, letting things come and go is contrary to what the mind likes to do. The mind wants to store up and accumulate and always remember and make sure things stay the same and all that kind of stuff. Sort of people think that the conservative position on the mind is as stupid as the conservative position of the Republican Party. So, but don't get too attached to your own liberating insights, because after a while they'll become some kind of pro forma dogma like it usually does religion. That's why spirituality declined to religion. By the time a spiritual liberation becomes a religion, it's no longer spiritually liberating. It's just merely another religion, which is like another political system. If you become very doctrinaire about the scientific method, you will miss some things you might have observed were you not trying to be strictly scientific. I mean, anything, a pure version of anything is in danger of being so pure that it excludes all new information. For example, there's a new book out by Christopher Ryan called Sex at Dawn, which is about the way hunter-gatherer tribes lived together for like the last 200,000 years. And what he said is that all the political science and all the so-called anthropologists and psychologists and social psychologists and everything that talked about hunter-gatherer culture, now that we have better science, we understand more and can read more from the artifacts we have that we've never been able to before, that we've learned new scientific ways of going about finding out how life was for those people, that they travel in bands of 50 to 150 people, and that for the last 195,000 years, of the last 200,000 years, 195,000, we were in bands of about 50 to 150 people. Everybody had sex with everybody else. There was no such thing as monogamy. The males were parents to all the children, and the females gave birth to the children that they gave birth to, but everyone they'd had sex with was considered the father. And if you wanted to have a strong child, you wanted to have sex with a variety of men, because they thought babies came from the accumulation of semen. Now that we have this kind of information, basically we see that the science was merely a projection backwards to say that monogamy goes all the way back to anywhere. It doesn't go back anywhere beyond the agricultural revolutions, whenever men, people started owning land and growing food and storing it. Therefore, then the men owned the women and the families because they were workers to develop the land and expand what was stored. And there's where corporate capitalism got born, and that's why we're about to bring about an end to humanity in the world, because of that one stupid aberration called corporate capitalism. So it's like not, when you say so, when someone says they're a scientist, they may or may not be a scientist with regard to observing whether or not their automatic assumptions are being applied to their observations or not. So that we can't trust so-called neutral observers unless they somehow prove their neutrality, unless you get some kind of cohorted, co-intelligent consensus about what is actually occurring rather than what is projected backwards. That's just one example.
And I think it connects to you pointing out or abdicating telling all your secrets, such as telling your spouse about the affair you had in detail. Can you tell listeners why you advocate that?
Well, I spent about 35 years as a clinical psychologist in Washington, D.C., and I saw a lot of people that worked for the government, and lots of lawyers and lobbyists, and lots of people that worked for industry related to the government, so it was kind of automatic that I became an expert in lying, because there's no better place in the world to become an expert in lying than Washington, D.C., and there's no better group of people to work with than the liars who maintain the government in Washington, D.C. I've actually seen more lawyers than any other single profession over the course of my professional career. Lots of them in groups, lots of couples, and lots of individual therapy, and lots of work with people who were successful but unhappy. There are people who are making like a half a million or a million or a couple million a year and going through their second divorce and giving up half of all they owned and everything and being miserable and working 80 hours a week in a law firm. And they couldn't understand why they were miserable. And I would say I couldn't understand how they could expect to be anything other than miserable. What happens is that we have a culture in which you're told that who you are is your reputation. So we all learn that in the course of growing up, that who we are is what other people think of us. We work to build the image that we imagine is in the mind of other people. That's the way you make it in this society. You're taught that you're a good little boy or a good little girl or a bad little boy or a bad little girl. I use actually Catholic parochial schools, the perfect model of poisonous education to teach people to be neurotic and stupid when they grow up to adulthood. So it's fundamentally, we're taught the lie that our identity has to do with what we, our image is in the minds of other people. That we are the grades we make. We're what the teacher thinks of us. We're what our peers think of us when we're teenagers. And as we grow on up, we're what we promote as ourselves and how successful we appear to be. And all that is basically not so. Who we are noticing things. Right now, I'm a person talking on a telephone to you. People are listening to this whenever it's played. And they're hearing what I'm saying. They might be talking with each other and thinking about it. that present tense noticing person that all of us are right now is and can be considered to be our fundamental identity. That identity is primary, up front, first. That is who I am, first and foremost. Being who is now noticing, who's talking, who's thinking, etc. That kind of being, that being, is hardly talked about at all, except as people come into psychotherapy and they become miserable because they're trying to live up to the BS expectations of the culture they grew up in. And particularly Western culture, the Judeo-Christian tradition and related traditions are filled with this ideology that has to do with who you are as your reputation. That fundamental false identity is based on something you maintain. The way you maintain it is by lying. You exaggerate how good you are. You tell stories that are elaborations of ideology about how you should be. You try to do a sales pitch about what a wonderful, good person you are, and constantly advertising what a good lover, what a good person, what a good father, what a good provider, what a good, etc. Some kind of promotional plan for your image in the mind of other people. So the whole culture lives inside of individual minds. We live in a culture, and the culture lives in us. As long as you're living only in your culture, in your mind, you're basically as detached from reality as any other psychotic human being.
That's a criticism.
Yeah. I do not think the United States of America is the greatest country in the world, not even close, not even in the top 80. I think what goes on in the United States is basically a pack of lies. And basically what goes on in the United States Congress is a bunch of lies. I've been constantly out there, available to be arrested and busted various times. You know, I don't know, I've been arrested 30 or 40 times, I guess. I've been doing this since the Civil Rights Movement. I've been going and getting arrested once or twice a year just to maintain my own personal.
I should mention also to the listeners that this is another dimension to your life and your work is you're an activist as well. And
yes.
It goes all the way back to growing up in Texas and being an activist in the civil rights movement. And I want to talk about that as well. But you brought up the issue with the country, and that's a kind of macro look at things, applying the same analysis of radical honesty. Lying is normal, as you have pointed out, but journalists and reporters barely tell the truth about events, and there's some kind of distortion or disinformation or a half-truth to sell a product, or it's an agenda, things like that.
Right.
There are physiological repercussions for withholding the truth and maintaining a pile of lies.
Yes, right.
And that applies to the country as well.
Yes. So we all maintain a kind of a mental illness and also a kind of physical illness that has to do with being attached to things that we would, if we were paying attention to our experience, we wouldn't think we're so great, but we think they're great because we've been sold a lot of ideology about what's great, what's not great. So I think basically what makes radical honesty radical is merely that it's unusual given that you're not expected to be honest. When people go back home, I do an 8-day long workshop called The Course in Honesty, and I have for about 20 some years. I'm going to be doing an online course soon called The Course in Completion, about people getting complete with their families, getting to forgiveness. So they get complete with their parents. They tell them the truth about everything they've hidden from them. They tell them what they resented them for that they were hiding. They tell them what they appreciate them for. And they talk about it until everybody's sitting in the room and nobody has any axe to grind and there's no information that hasn't been shared. And then they say, okay, now how are we going to do our familying from here on? In the big beginning, that's strongly resisted by parents and kids and brothers and sisters and everything else. But after it goes, or after they do it, then they end up calling me back or emailing and saying how grateful they are because they now are having Thanksgiving and Christmases and things together where they're really, really sharing their lives and really helping each other rather than just, oh my God, I have to go home for Christmas and have it be a dreadful, dreading kind of thing.
You really see those breakthroughs. That's the common response?
Yes. It's radical honesty delivers you from the jail of your own mind. And it often delivers your whole family from the jail of their minds. And you start getting back together again based on something that is so rather than on maintaining some kind of pretense. Authenticity is much better than pretense. That's where love happens. It's where people actually get real support for each other and really help each other. It's when people are actually telling the truth about what they think, what they feel, and what they've done. Now, it doesn't work like absolutely guaranteed all the time. We have a bumper sticker that says, radical honesty works pretty good most of the time. That's our best ad right there. It's like, if it doesn't work, okay, maybe it didn't work that time. Try it again, try it some more. But what happens is it works a hell of a lot better than the alternative. Because when you tell the truth and let the chips fall where they may, you're going to have some trouble in short range because you're violating the implicit agreement you have with other people to play like everything's okay when it isn't. They don't like that because it's threatening to them. So they'll get mad or they'll get their feelings hurt or they'll get upset or they'll say they don't want anything to do with you for a while or something like that. I say go ahead and take the risk and go through that. Because it doesn't take long to get over being hurt. It doesn't take long to get over being angry. When you're honest, it doesn't take very long to get over it. But when you lie about it, it takes forever to get over it. Tell the truth and let the chips fall where they may. What's radical about it is that you're not willing to engage in the conspiracy of lies that make up your family systems unit, your culture, or whatever it is, your business, whatever association of group you are with people. If you actually start telling the truth and sticking with each other, whenever you get your feelings hurt or get offended, until you get over it, you'll find that that's a much better policy than playing along and going along to get along and maintaining a lie and not mentioning. You know, the worst, the most pernicious form of lying is withholding. It's merely not saying what you're really thinking, not saying what you really feel, not saying what you thought about what somebody said or what went on or not saying what you did or said, or it's that withholding.
Why is that? Why is it the most pernicious?
Because it's easy to simply not mention things. It takes an impetus and action on your part to talk about something that's being ignored or avoided. And it's the easy route. You say, oh, well, I won't say anything. You're engaging in a conspiracy of avoidance with your friends.
Is it still important at any point to keep a secret?
Well, I don't recommend that you're radically honest through and through with everybody in your life. Radical honesty is for everyone that you know personally, in all your personal relationships. I don't recommend that you're honest. If you have Anne Frank in the attic and a Nazi knocks on the door and says, there ain't Jews in this house, lie. I had clients that were in the CIA and they would send FBI people to talk to me about, and I was supposed to have to tell them everything went on with people in therapy in order for them to maintain their security clearance. One of their questions they always ask is, "Is your knowledge of this person ever used any illegal drugs?" And I'd say, not to my knowledge, and I'd been stunned with it like the week before. I asked the FBI guy one time, "You ever smoked any marijuana?" He said, "No." I said, "Sure. Now we're even. Come on to your next question." And he laughed, and I laughed, because everybody in D.C. knows it's a bullshit pretense anyway. The thing is that just walking through a tundra of bullshit Washington, D.C. is like trying to swim an ocean of waves of bullshit. It's like basically...
I'm going to have to bleep that out every time you say it, by the way.
Yeah,
I'm going to be editing for hours if you...
Okay. You see, the very fact that you have to bleep that out is bullshit.
Agreed. Yes. You know, you were radically honest about why you wrote the book. That was the funniest thing I've read in a long time. That cracked me up. So it's hilarious at the same time. Why is it so funny?
I figure I might as well be honest about my particular delusional system there, too.
It was very funny. But some of that is true in terms of how we view ourselves.
Actually, it is true. What happens, a lot of my training groups, a lot of people that are radical honesty trainers trained by me, and are people who are hilariously funny, and they're funny because they come off it frequently. They say, they'll advocate something stringently and then at the end say, or not. we spend a lot of time laughing with each other, at each other. When you can laugh at yourself with other people around, and they are compassionately laughing at you with you, it's one of the most wonderful, liberating, and relieving things that can happen. It's a community of people who still love you without buying your pretense, and particularly love you for giving up on your pretense. I would go so far as to say that really love doesn't happen without giving up pretense. You can have some semblance of it or act like you think someone's so great because they perform so well on something. But basically, what you love people for is venturing forth, putting it out there, taking a risk, opening up, showing, being vulnerable, being able to be authentic, whether it is pro forma form you're supposed to behave or not. That's what's lovable about little kids. That's why I love children so much, is that you don't have to teach children, to be honest. You basically, adults are busily teaching them how to lie. But from 2 or 3 or 4 or 5, what's so endearing about children at those ages is they just say it, whatever it is, right or wrong. By the time they get to be 9 or 10 or 11, they start pretending that everything's okay when it isn't. And then when they get to be teenagers, they start pretending that they're not pretending when they are.
Wow.
And that's where lying comes from. That's what maintains this culture that we're in, is a bunch of people pretending. And you can have a great time playing pretend games. I love playing pretend games with little kids. And that we be all different kinds of roles, play all kinds of heroes and heroines and everything like that. And it's so much fun. It's a lot of, they laugh, we all laugh, it's funny. And then when you get to be about 11 or 12, you're still pretending, but you're pretending that you're not pretending while you still are. And that right there is the big lie that needs to be undone over and over again. When you undo that lie and you give up your pretense, people love you for it, just like you love other people when they do, because you recognize, oh, what a relief now. We don't have to keep on engaged in this conspiracy of pretense.
Because it's a lot of work to remember the story or that narrative. And
Yeah. You got to keep track of what you told people and what kind of impression you're trying to make.
Our guest is Brad Blanton, the author of many books, but we're talking about his first book, Radical Honesty, How to Transform Your Life by Telling the Truth. We've had on a guest that discussed the harmfulness of lies in the United States, living in a culture filled with lies in the U.S. and having the lies be supported in a very crafty way, subtle way within the progressive media. And he pointed out that it's harmful to the arts, and such as music, writing, literature, and poetry, you know, various types of visual art. It's harmful to culture.
Uh-huh, yeah. I agree. It's not as though the truth has to be extracted. It's just that the lies have to be interrupted, and the truth is sitting right there.
Can you briefly tell listeners about this truth machine?
Well, there's been a lot of stuff done by the ARPA, the Advanced Research Projects Agency, the Pentagon, and CIA. There are about 30 to 34 secret agencies that our taxes pay for, by the way. Some of them you know about and some of them don't, but anyway, of that tremendous military budget, a lot of it has gone to trying to figure out when people are lying. And so we have a lot of technology and a lot of people that if we put them together, we could call it a truth machine. Take psychotherapists like myself who can tell pretty good when people are lying, bartenders, taxi drivers, and all of the technology of being able to use the usual lie detector test with enhanced lie detector tests. And if you take all these things in combination, you can have about 85 to 90% certainty
Wow.
when someone is lying. And I'm suggesting that anybody has a contract to propose, or a marriage, or a merger, or a division of assets, that they, both parties agree, or all the parties involved agree, to go before the truth machine. And we would say whether these people are telling the truth or not, to validate the contract in advance. And I believe if people thought they could get caught lying and were pretty highly certain that if a neutral force of people said, no, I'm sorry, you don't want a contract with this person, they're lying, that people would give up lying because it would be pretty likely that they'd get caught. And they'd work out a way to work things out without lying. So that's what I propose. I call it the truth machine. And it's described in a chapter in the Corporate Cannibal Cookbook.
Wow, that is absolutely fascinating. That's on my reading list. I'm going to get that book with the original title as soon as I can before you change it.
All right.
Brad Blanton, thank you again for being on the show. Brad is the author of the nationwide bestseller, Radical Honesty, How to Transform Your Life by Telling the Truth. There's so much more to cover, but just another reason to have you back on the show.
Well, thank you very much. I really enjoyed it, and I appreciate you for interviewing me, and I appreciate you for what you do, and I like Civica Radio particularly.
Fantastic. Thanks very much. That's going to do it for In Other News. I'm Jeff Brady. Visit inothernewsradio.com for archives and more information about the guests.